gentlemen, boys and girls, Diantide is here. That's right, we are still talking Jason Goes to Hell, the final Friday on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from Crystal Lake, or as close as we could possibly afford. And this is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. So we will be unpacking all the gory details of, well, it's not really Friday the 13th anymore. It's Jason Goes to Hell, the final Friday, in the hopes that a townsperson's end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make about them. And as always, there's only one person that I trust to help me steal a body from the morgue so that we can snag great ratings, the one and only Gina Radcliffe. How you doing, Gina?
I don't know. I haven't recovered from the last episode. I feel like I have shed my skin and have been born anew, but not in a good way. In a way that just feels sort of, you know, unclean. Like I just sort of have this kind of layer of like ooze on my skin, and I find the sight of razors upsetting. I find the sight of dining room tables upsetting, which is inconvenient. I just been kind of walking around for the past week with this sort of wince on my face. And every once in a while, I will just let out a shudder, which is good, because that'll ensure that nobody ever sits next to me on the subway. But it's impractical for everyday life.
I think of it akin to, I don't know if this experience has ever happened to you, but I happened to crawl into a sleeping bag one very cold night while camping, an activity that I dislike intensely. But I crawled in and I managed to fall asleep, and it was very cold, and I cuddled up very tight. And when I woke up in the morning, I discovered that my feet were full of mud, and so the inside of my sleeping bag was now full of mud, and I was covered in it.
Oh.
That's how I feel about the last section of this movie.
Exactly.
I feel filthy, but it's fascinating how it happened.
Filthy and uncomfortable.
Yeah. I don't know that its aim is to make me comfortable, so that is one thing for certain, but I don't want to scare you, Gina. We are not alone. That's right, we have a special guest with us. He is a bona fide Hollywood screenwriter and the host of his own podcast, Dead for Filth, the one and only Michael Verratti. How are you doing, sir?
Hello, thanks for having me.
I am so happy that you are here. I love your podcast. I love what you do. And as soon as I saw you sort of pop up amongst the horror Twitterverse, I said, I've got to get that person on the podcast. And specifically, I thought, I want to know what he thinks of this weird-ass movie.
It truly is, but I'm truly honored to be here. I'm excited that you have taken on this monumental task of logging and discussing all of the kills of Camp Crystal Lake and beyond. I mean, my hat's off to you from the whole horror community. This is no small endeavor.
No, it's not a small endeavor. It is useless, though. So... So we have a tradition here at the Kill by Kill podcast. We always like to ask our guests what their first experience was being exposed to the Friday the 13th franchise. What was yours?
You know, honestly, it would probably be a screening of Friday the 13th, the final chapter on USA Up All Night. Because I was a very ardent watcher of Up All Night back during its heyday at the end of the 80s and the early 90s. And a lot of the horror movies of the era I was introduced to because I would stay up late and watch them. And, you know, the irony of that, since I'm on a podcast all about the kills, and, you know, the kills are what are celebrated by gore hounds and horror fans, when they were aired on network TV, were often very truncated. So when the movies came to me later via VHS or, you know, otherwise, I got to kind of re-experience them all again for the first time. But I know that my first Friday was definitely with Rhonda Shear on USA Up All Night. And I know it was the final chapter because I always remember Trish and Tommy and kind of in battle with Jason at the end. But as I discussed with you before the show started, I have a long thread of Crystal Lake interaction throughout my career, so I'm very fond of this franchise, and from that first moment on, I've just been in love with it.
You know, it's one of those things where, unlike maybe the Halloweens or the Nightmare on Elm Streets of the world, it doesn't have that singular film that rises above all else. But as a whole, I think it's super worthy of discussion.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have been wasting my time and Gina's. I've probably wasted a great deal of my time. Gina, I can't explain why she's followed me down this weird-ass rabbit hole. So let's get right into it. Let's do a quick body count. Let's remind everyone who is still left alive at this point in the movie. The answer is just about everyone, because we've only met some of the protagonists. In fact, in this section of the movie, we'll meet someone who is supposed to be a main character who has not appeared until 38 minutes into it. So let's run them down real quick. First, there's Diana. She's a secret Voorhees in the streets and a Victoria's Secret in the sheets. And then we have Sheriff Grandpa, who is Diana's paramour. But as we learned with her conversation with Deputy Josh, she would like more at this stage in her life than just a boyfriend. She wants someone to settle down with. We also have Steven, who we learn from his wardrobe, lettered in getting girls pregnant. And of course,
what's the symbol what's the symbol for that? Like a positive pregnancy test or like a sperm cell entering an egg?
It's a stick with a positive sign on it.
That's a very specific patch, though, that you have to order from the company.
They have to make them specifically. Once upon a time, I was a Boy Scout, and I got out of it very quickly because I hated camping and Boy Scouting and the whole fucking thing. But my father forced me to go to the Boy Scout Jamboree, which is held once every few years back in the part of Virginia where lightning strikes it all the time. Because every single Boy Scout Jamboree, you always read Boy Scout hit by lightning.
Oh, wow.
But we designed our own patches for that for reasons I can't begin. But there were the various groupings got to design their own patch or decide what their group was called. And we were the Peanut Men. We had a patch with a Mr. Peanut lounging on a beach.
Do I want to know the origin of this name?
I think someone said Peanut Man and we all laughed because we were fucking goofs. Probably when it comes down to it. And I was just like, whatever. When I got back from this trip, my parents were very disappointed because they had purchased a camera for me to take pictures. And many of my pictures were blurry. And they're like, why are all these pictures of Washington, D.C. and the surrounding areas blurry? And my answer was simple. We weren't allowed to stop and stand. We walked everywhere. And like, there's the Washington Monument. And we walked right past it. There's Congress. Walked right past it.
I've been trying to walk past Congress for years.
That's right. So that was a long digression for nothing. Okay. And finally, last but not least, is Creighton Duke, our favorite character. We're going to put favorite in dick fingers.
Oh, no. He's definitely the best character. I have never seen any movie character who is able to generate such blistering one-sided sexual tension with every person he encounters. I mean, just
he kind of wants to fuck everything.
He is constantly undressing everybody with his eyes.
But the only one he seemingly has sexual chemistry with is himself.
Yes. It's him, that cigar, and whatever is happening underneath that Undertaker from the 1988 WrestleMania gear that he's sporting 24/7.
Now, I read that he only agreed to take the part, Stephen Williams, who plays Creighton Duke, if they let him dress like a cowboy. That was his condition for playing the character. And I just love that decision. Like, you know, who reads this script and was like, you know what Creighton Duke needs is a whole lot of Wild Bunch.
He needs a duster.
A big old 10-gallon hat.
I need to flash a knife during interviews, and I need to fondle fingers in a way that doesn't seem right.
Which they let him keep. They let him keep the hat in his jail cell, which I find implausible. like as if to suggest that everything else that happens in this movie is completely plausible. I take pause in the fact they let him keep his hat in the holding cell.
He could have hung himself with that hat.
Well, there's a strap around the brim, so yeah, anything's possible. He could be keeping a weapon in there. His whole body is a weapon, we learn. The thing I don't quite understand about Creighton Duke is this. He is a bounty hunter whose master plan for capturing and or killing Jason Voorhees is going into town and getting himself arrested immediately.
And then recruiting someone else to do the work for him.
That's right. You go out and grab me that $500,000. I'll be right here in this jail cell.
This nice, safe, comfortable jail cell.
It is a long-standing policy of mine as a working screenwriter to never, you know, besmirch the work of anyone else because, you know, like, no one sets out to make a bad movie or whatever. But I do think there are elements of this film that feel like the Friday the 13th fan fiction that somehow was given a green light with a budget. And I kind of think that's part of the charm, though, in a way. But I also am aware of the fact that the original runtime of the movie was something like 130 minutes, and they cut it down, which is why there's a lot of, like, kookiness in terms of actual narrative structure.
Wait. You're saying this movie was edited?
Oh. I mean, not just edited, but they chopped out 60 minutes of movie.
Because I literally, I was running late because I was watching the segment we're covering, because that's how I do it. I do each segment per right before the episode, and normally I'm done by the time we're scheduled to record, and just this keeps going. I mean, that scene in the jail cell was interminable. And you're telling me that there was more?
Oh.
Well, I think that's where it comes from that you had stated in the last episode, Gina, that it often feels like this was a Jason Goes to Hell TV series, and we only started watching in the third episode, because everyone talks like, well, you know, because Steven had, you know, got Diana's daughter pregnant. And you're like, what? We haven't even met this daughter. Why is Josh trying to convince Diana to stay with the sheriff? We've only seen them in one scene together. Now I think it's kind of coming into focus. They had a whole lot of character in this, and I still think it's a very character-forward movie, but they had a whole lot more, and they just started taking chunks out of it to make it move along.
I was saying, so they could add another minute or two of Deputy Josh turning into a puddle of silly putty.
I really like that read that this feels like an episode of a series that we've come into. That's an interesting kind of take on it, because I can see exactly what you're talking about. The other thing, and I don't know if you've mentioned this on previous episodes discussing this film, that I personally find interesting is that John DeLamay, who plays Steven, was also in the Friday the 13th television series, but as a completely different character. And in my brain, because it carries the name, they're like in the same world. So it's just kind of interesting. I don't know.
Yeah. I definitely wonder why exactly they made that decision. Because... again, that was a division of Paramount Television. I think it came through Atlantis or whatever their, you know, Canadian subsidiary was. So now this has gone to New Line. And that's where I think we get, that's where I feel this gets that sort of fanfic idea, is that New Line had forever, you know, made their bones on the Nightmare on Elm Street series, which was very supernatural forward. And they have purchased this property that isn't all that supernatural outside of one psychic girl and an undead dude. And that's pretty much it.
Right.
And so they tried to, like, well, what do we know? What do we know? What do we know? Demons crawling out of bodies, hell. And they just kind of pushed all of the things that they were comfortable with onto a Friday the 13th. It makes it very different. I don't know that it wears that suit very well, but they're certainly going for it. They're swinging for the fences.
Well, the thing that I always feel like kind of helps that justification too is it doesn't carry the banner name of Friday the 13th for the legal reasons they couldn't get it from Paramount. But
right. It
also, it's sort of like if you are a fan of the Friday movies and this movie feels like a big departure, you can make sort of the fan decision of being like, well, it's a different company. It's a different name. It's sort of like a Jason-inspired film, but it sort of could be in a different universe if you wanted it to be. Which means we would have last seen Jason in a vat of toxic waste in Manhattan, and that's where it ends. So,
and somewhere out there, there's a comic book that supposedly tells us the journey of him coming back. But the other thing is we've been given one kind of semi-answer from Duke as to why, even if he was a 10-year-old boy awashed of his meat suit by toxic waste, which runs in the, you know, rivers underneath New York City. We all know this. These are things that we all know. And his journey back to New Jersey is that whatever is on top of Jason is just this hulk of constantly regrowing homunculi that he builds up, which is why, you know, his head looks like a mad ball at the beginning of this. So let's get right into it. Let's pick up the action where we left off, and that's with Deputy Josh getting strapped to a sex harness, getting freshly shaved, and getting a mouthful of Jason heartworm, which is a thing that actually happens in this movie. And Michael, I'm going to ask you a question that I asked our last guests, but I want to see what your take is on this. Now, the idea here is that inside the Voorhees Manor, there's this sex harness that the coroner Jason has strapped down Deputy Josh to with chains, belts, and straps.
Sure.
Then he puts the heartworm into Deputy Josh, who is powerless to stop him because of these chains and straps. And my question to you is, how the fuck does Deputy Josh now get out of the sex harness?
Oh, I mean, that's a good question. I thought you were going to ask, like...
Yes! Finally! Woo!
I thought you were going to ask, you know, under what master plan did Jason need to shave him? Also... I mean, well, like,
that's just fun. That's just fun, Michael. Like, sometimes
it's also the most calculated thing we've ever, like, the most calculated and precise thing we've ever seen Jason Voorhees do. It means that he actually is capable of, like, doing precision work that he had to, like, shave someone. That's like fucking, I'm sorry, am I allowed to swear on this?
Oh, fuck yes.
Okay, good. I swear so much on my own podcast, I forget I need to ask when I go into other people's. But the idea is just like, wait, why was this necessary? But yeah, okay, so there's this sort of like, I don't know, sex dungeon, pseudo Clive Barker scene going on here. I can't, you know, I'm just going to assume, using Jason logic, that like, now that worm Jason spirit thing is inside of Deputy Josh, he just was able to bust out of his constraints. Because, okay, you know, Jason somehow has, like, superhuman strength, even though, like, one single chain kept him at the bottom of a lake for 20 years.
Oh, come on, Michael. Magic lake.
That's right. Yeah, you got me there.
Aha! Now the student has become the master.
No, I just assume that he probably broke out using Jason's strength. But, I mean, who knows? Who knows? Maybe the Necronomicon let him out, which is a whole discussion later.
It's entirely a possibility. Yeah. Oh, yeah. This movie's got it all, including things it wasn't legally allowed to use. So we're going to start up the action here where we meet Jessica, and that's Diana's daughter. She's a woman that's so beautiful that having an infant child in her hair underneath a baseball cap doesn't keep her from landing a TV host boyfriend. She has it all. And she's calling Diana at her apartment, and... Diana's apartment's pretty awesome.
I was going to say, I noted here, she lives in an incredibly nice house for a diner waitress.
what are home prices happening? We know she didn't get her money from selling the Voorhees Manor, because that's still up and alive so that Scooby-Doo and the gang can check it out at various points.
I mean, look, I'm assuming money goes a long way in Crystal Lake because it's a murder town. Like, it's sort of like one of those places, like, who wants to move there? Like, here, have a 9-bedroom house for a low $500 rent. And you're like, what a steal. It's because you're going to, like, end up dismembered before the end of the week.
That's right. It's the kind of place that you want to rent, not own, because, like, what are the chances you're going to live? Sure, I'll take that. So Diana receives a call from her daughter, Jessica, who says, I'm coming to visit. I'm bringing the baby. Make sure Steven isn't around because I don't want to see him. And Diana's like, sure. So we don't know what the fuck is happening in this relationship. We just know that, listen, just because you have a baby with somebody doesn't mean you want to spend the rest of your life with them. This is perfectly fine with me. But we get no explanations. Maybe it happens later in the movie.
I just think it's funny that, what was the reporter's name again?
Robert
Campbell?
Yes, Robert Campbell.
So Jessica is, her boyfriend is Robert Campbell, and again, we are told this because their body language suggests that they have just met that day. And I mean, really, how can you compete with, you know, the raw, you know, sexual energy that Creighton Duke brings to every encounter he has with everybody? But I mean, these two, I mean, he just like looks at her like he's just kind of, well, all right, I guess she'll do.
Robert Campbell. Robert Campbell has all the eroticism of an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I don't get it. It's...
Yeah, they try a little too hard to, you know, get across this guy's a sleazeball. It's like, yeah, we kind of figured that already. You don't have to continuously emphasize that over and over and over again.
We don't get a lot of this interaction because Deputy Josh breaks in silently. No one rings the doorbell. We don't hear a chain snap or anything like that. He just saunters into the room like he owns the place. And that's where he attacks Diana and attempts to pass on the Jason Heartworm to her. And we're not entirely sure why at this point, although we are about to learn why that is.
An excruciating detail.
But their interaction really doesn't last very long because Diana fucking caps his ass with a gunshot to the head just in the nick of time. So Jason zombies don't need brains?
Well, it's a different kind of possession.
So basically the heart of the Jason worm is now taking over for the brain of any given.
Yeah, they've gone some interesting directions with the zombie mythos in this movie.
Because if we take like the hidden logic, which this movie is, you know, borrowing from heavily, once you incapacitate the body's ability to keep living, the alien moves on to the next one. But here he's able to keep bodies going far longer than what is happening in the hidden. And I guess, you know, I wish it had rules. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, I think that we said this about other movies in the past, but they're trying a lot of different things in this and they're not always consistent. Like I don't want to give anything away about a scene coming up, but I have a question regarding the consistency of things that happen to certain characters, but we'll get to it.
She tries to get out of the room, but in typical horror movie fashion, Josh Jason is still alive, and we are treated to what basically amounts to a graphic attempted rape sequence, which is not fun to talk about, so I won't.
Let's just lay this, but one thing I couldn't help but notice is that these iterations of Jason make more noise in this movie than any of the other Jasons combined. They're all grunting, sure. They're growling, they're making like these like comical little monster noises, and like literally, and it's not scary. I don't know that it's trying to be funny, but it's very disconcerting because I feel like this is a, you know, Jason Voorhees is mentioned, but this really isn't a Friday the 13th movie. This is a monster movie. Yes. And it's just so funny and odd to, you know, have these characters who are supposed to be, you know, new incarnations of Jason. And they're, like I said, they sound like bears, the cartoon bears.
I give each of them, like, new names. That's how I was enjoying it throughout. Like, right now, this is Deputy Jason, and then coming up, we've got Jason News at 11. So,
let's take that on. I like it. It's even better than Deputy Josh. Deputy Jason is, you know, trying desperately to pass on that curse to Diana, and who should arrive without knocking or ringing the doorbell either is Steven. This is Crystal Lake Manners. You just walk into someone's fucking home. He tackles Deputy Jason immediately, gets his ass handed to him in a pretty shocking manner. Hold on, guys, hold on. I'm sorry, I had an emergency. My son had strapped a dog collar around his neck and couldn't get it off. Please don't do that again. Can you agree to that?
No.
Yes, no, you can't. You have to agree to that. All right, take Nigel with you, please. Nigel, go. Please do not harm yourself or others. What do you mean you will? God damn it.
He must be listening to the podcast.
Oh. He's asked several times. There's no fucking way. We went to Universal Studios, Hollywood, which is where my wife and I met as studio guides. And we were on the tram tour, and you go by the Psycho House, and they now have an actor portraying the lead character,
Norman Bates.
Psycho. Norman Bates. So they have a performer coming out as Norman Bates, put a dead body in the back of the trunk, and then notice the tram, and then walk towards it with a knife in his hand. And he had nightmares for 3 fucking days. In the middle of the Transformers ride line, he's like, "What is Psycho about?" Now I have to explain the movie Psycho to my son while robots fight one another. It was very interesting. He is not ready for this. Okay. Where were we? Oh, Steven. Yeah. So Steven walks into the room, tackles Deputy Jason, and gets his ass handed to him very quickly. He is not prepared to do battle with a supernatural transferring worm demon man, but that's okay. Diana comes over and stabs him in the back with a poker, a fireplace poker, which is the first time we've seen a fireplace poker pushed through somebody since part 3. So if you had that on your bingo card, knock it off one more time.
Oh, but this one wasn't in 3D, so I'm calling shenanigans.
That's true. It wasn't red hot, it wasn't in 3D, and a person didn't react to it like you had just stolen their last rice cake out of the closet.
We do get understated reactions coming up very soon, though.
We're back on that bullshit. So he gets stabbed with that fireplace poker, and he becomes mystified with himself in the mirror. He becomes hypnotized by his own reflection, and he sees Jason in the mirror. And that's when we get to see real Jason breathing hard again, but none of the Jason zombies breathe hard. Why aren't they carrying on his mannerisms?
Are you seriously asking, or are you, or because I would just chalk this up to they just didn't consider that.
Okay, I'll take that as an answer. Sure, why not? There's no real answer. Deputy Jason reacts to this somehow, and he reaches into a knife block.
He pulls a knife sharpener.
Yes.
Which, and the look on his face is like, well, this will do the job. Well, not really. I mean, it did, but I mean, I'm not quite sure why he decided to choose that.
It's not a very balanced weapon, and yet he's able to throw it through Diana's spine, and she leaves this mortal coil, which, again, as far as what Jason's plan is here, he does need Diana's body. It's not his only avenue, but we later learn there's a reason why he's attacking Diana. He needs a body. Hers is one of the ones that'll work, so why kill her? Or is Steven using Diana as a human shield?
Well, I think it is supposed to suggest she kind of, you know, steps in front of him or is just badly placed. But I do appreciate Steven's reaction to seeing the grandmother of his child, correct? Who you know, is very kind to him. You presumably would like things for him to work out between him and her daughter. Is you murdered right before his very eyes. His reaction is, oh, shit. He is carrying on like he just dropped a tray of drinks.
I kind of feel like a lot of the reactions to the murders in this movie are pretty underwhelming, and the only justification I can make for it is it's like, oh, well, we live in Crystal Lake, it's Tuesday. Or, you know, it's just like, we just, like, you know, we're so used to this. It's like, you're lucky if you make it to 22 because, secrets, everyone gets killed. Because they're just so sort of, like, nonplussed by a lot of it.
They don't seem present sometimes, and I don't know if it's, you know, listen, a movie set is a crazy place. You're picking things up in pieces. You're sitting around for a really long time while you arrange something under the lights or makeup or special effects or whatever it is. But this film does suffer somewhat. And part 3 has many of the same problems of lackluster reactions to the fantastical. It's just one of those things. Now, Steven manages to scramble to safety. I'm sorry. Steven is the one who rams a poker through Deputy Jason's torso. I got that wrong. That's where that happens. And then Deputy Jason defenestrates himself because, again, Jason hates windows and doors. and he lands on the grass and ends up disappearing when the cops arrive, a la Michael Myers. That's a Michael Myers thing. That and driving a car when you've never driven one before. Jason Voorhees breaking through doors and windows and driving a boat. That's how the thing breaks down. Freddy can do whatever he wants because he lives in people's dreams, but these people have rules.
Well, also, I kind of like, you know, we know that Freddy had like a whole human life before he got burned by the PTA or whatever it was. And I think that that's always my favorite part of the Nightmare franchise that no one ever talks about, where it's just like, your dad and I and a bunch of the parents got together. I'm like, whoa, Springwood's got the craziest parent-teacher association I've ever seen, that they're just going to go light up the janitor. And then they keep evidence of his murder, like, just in the house. Yes. There's a whole lot going on there. But no, I mean, Jason and Michael are kind of rudimentary. They can only do a few things. But I assume that, like, probably in his life, like, Freddy made Pop-Tarts and things before he got killed. So there's just like...
Oh, you better believe it. Giant Pop-Tart fan, Freddy Krueger. Oh, and he liked the terrible ones, the chocolate ones. He didn't even like fruit flavors like a normal American. That's how you could tell something was wrong with him.
Freddy's true nightmare were the discontinued Pop-Tart flavors.
That's right. He had a passion for them. He was a collector. So at this very moment, Diana tries to pass on her secret to Steven, but is unable to communicate it. That doesn't stop the movie from lingering over the shot for a full minute. But who should arrive but the third person to not knock or break in the door, just saunters into the room, is Sheriff Grandpa. He arrives to find Steven covered in blood and Diana dead. And yet, Steven is simply arrested and not shot on sight because...
This is another thing where they really just went to town with the editing in this, because I feel like Steven is supposed to be maybe the town bad boy. I mean, he doesn't look like the town bad boy, but
oh my god, do you think that this character was supposed to be the bad boy and they cast him to be that character?
Well, because the way that the sheriff looks at him, like, of course you killed her. Why is this completely unsurprising? Of course, you know, a woman's dead and you're standing here. I mean, even though there's, you know, a shattered window, there's probably some evidence that a body was on the ground outside initially before he picked himself up and walked away. But it's the way that, like, everybody is treating him, except the one deputy who is, you know, kind of, I guess he looks like he might have been a classmate of his because they're about the same age. But I feel like he's supposed to be, you know, the sort of anti-hero. But, you know, he looks like the paper boy. but I feel the character was initially supposed to be written like that, because otherwise why wouldn't the sheriff take his, well, you know, I got here and someone was attacking her. I mean, why wouldn't that be plausible to him if he didn't, you know, unless he already had some predetermined beef with this character that the audience never knows about.
Well, I do think a long-standing franchise issue over the course of all of the Friday films, with the exception of the sheriff at the top of part two who gets hammered to the head, is that whatever the employment litmus to be a police officer in Crystal Lake is not really that high of a bar. Because these people are not, like, really ever doing the most with their sleuthing. You live in a town where there's a known supernatural serial killer, and, like, and by proxy, with the exception of the break between 6 and 7, which is supposed to be a few decades, most of what happens is, like, within a few consecutive days. And the police are always just like, Jason, what are you talking about? No, they're not really good at what they do.
Yeah, the sheriff dad in part 6 was particularly egregious about pretending like he didn't know what had happened in his own town like a year earlier. And again, just sort of, you know, wrote off all the trouble that was happening in town because of this bad boy. And again, their definition of a bad boy kind of strongly differs from my own. Well, it must be this kid who, you know, has come into town and caused all this trouble, and not the hulking monster that killed 35 people, you know, last year.
Yeah, I like when the police department's solution is like, let's just change the name of the town. Then you know that maybe they're not really that great.
And then apparently had some sort of town meeting where they inform the parents, well, just tell your children it's a legend. None of this ever happened. Jason Voorhees didn't exist. This is even though this is something you could look up in a newspaper at your local library, just you tell your children who were alive when all this happened, that none of it actually really happened, and it was just a legend parents tell their kids to make sure they behave.
Oh my god, that's the cutscene I need from a Friday movie, where someone's like, to the public library! And they all, like, pile into the van, like, Tommy Jarvis drives them over, and they're, like, just looking through, or maybe they just have burned the, they burned the libraries down. That's how serious they are. They're like, no one must know.
It's like, oh, The Village.
It's cut off from all knowledge. And yet the word of Jason Voorhees is leaked out into the world. I just now realized there's only one police officer who's ever taken the threat of Jason Voorhees seriously. And that's in part 5. And Jason Voorhees is not in that movie. So even then, the police are wrong about the murderer. Because, like, it's got to be Jason Voorhees. And then the mayor, who comes from Philadelphia all of a sudden, is like, Jason Voorhees!
We're not closing the beaches because of Jason Voorhees.
I was gonna say, like, instead of wearing a jacket with little anchors, he's got a jacket with, like, little canoes all over it or something.
Oh, sweet God. Part 5 is terrible. So...
I like Roy. I'm going to say it.
Listen, I like Roy, too. I like how his jowls jostle when he's angry. I love that he has a wallet so full of Jason Voorhees newspaper clippings that there's no possible way he could sit down straight, because that wallet would always be tilting him to one side.
Let's talk about the use of Jason in newspaper clippings all throughout the franchise, because they do it in this movie too, and it's just something that I've always, like, been very fascinated by, because they clearly just use studio production stills, like, for, like, the local, like, Crystal Lake Times. And I want to know, I mean, obviously it's convenient because the movie, you know, studio has those, and it's like, we're going to make a prop and we're going to use this, like, really fancy photo. Yeah. But in the context of the world, who's this Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer that took these, like, well-lit, like, you know, with bounces and, like, sconce lighting of Jason Voorhees looking, like, pristine? I want to know who that person is. Like,
wielding a machete, like an action shot.
Jason, yes. Jason, I'm from the newspaper. Can you turn this way? No, tilt your head down so I can catch the light, because the light is coming over your shoulder. Perfect, perfect. Love it, love it. Breathe harder.
We all forgot that moment that Jason posed for Annie Leibovitz. So that's
right. They put on some Motown or some soft 70s singer-songwriter things, and Pamela's head was just off camera so he could look off wistfully at it. Perfect. This has been the photography, the Jason photography sketch from Kill by Kill.
Solid gold.
Perfect. Goes right up there with Jason's swimming lessons and Jason's swap meet fair. Okay. Oh god, where are we in this fucking movie? I've lost it. Jessica comes home and she meets Vicky, who must be her friend from high school, who's the second waitress at the restaurant.
Can I stop you for a moment and remark upon whatever the fuck it is Jessica's wearing in this scene? Because it looks like some sort of Starfleet funeral outfit.
And she's an admiral in a space navy.
Yeah, it's got these enormous shoulders. Not even shoulder pads. The shoulders themselves are, like, extending almost out like bat wings. And I was actually confused for a moment, because I thought, is she coming back from Diana's funeral? And then I'm like, okay, so she comes home from the funeral, and what's the other waitress's name? Vicky?
Vicky,
She's cleaning the blood. I'm like, oh no, she just arrived. Why is she dressed like this?
You assume that she's either arriving for or coming from the funeral based on this very lapel-heavy outfit, or it's the trenchiest of trench coats. I couldn't tell you why. But Vicky's...
Also, in keeping with crack police investigation, Steven is still walking around in the blood-soaked clothing that he was arrested in, which I am not a forensics expert, but I am pretty sure that if you are arrested for someone's murder and your blood is covered in, your clothing is covered in blood, that's coming right off.
Yeah, yeah.
You're gonna be putting like a paper suit or a hospital gown or something. But he's just walking around with like his entire front just covered in blood.
CSI Crystal Lake is not at the top of their game. This is the same crew that pulled an axe out of Jason's head with their bare fucking hands and then put it in a plastic bag. No, you gotta grab that with the plastic bag. Oh, these fucking people. They're gonna be the death of me.
I really want to see CSI Crystal Lake now, like an ongoing weekly series starring like a TV star of yesteryear. Adrian Paul is Detective Carruthers in CSI Crystal Lake. But like every episode, the crime is going on behind him. Like he's looking in the distance and
looks like this crime isn't cut and dry. Sunglasses up. Who song? Jason in the background, just continuing to kill somebody.
It's got to be something like, it's just got to be something completely out of place, like Squeezebox or something. Pinball Wizard.
Pinball Wizard. Oh, sweet Jesus. That would be fantastic. We've already come up with two things that are better than this movie within the movie. So congratulations, everyone. Is it me or has this baby aged from the first time that we saw it? The first time we see it, that baby has no hair. The next time we see it, it's got a lot of hair. So either hair grew in a lot in between shots or we got ourselves a different baby sitch.
I think what happened was lots and lots of reshoots.
I think you might be right about that one.
And they did not want to have to struggle with putting a bald cap on a baby.
But they put one on Corey Feldman. So, I mean, really, it's par for course with whatever's going on.
Oh, no. So Steven's bestest buddy on the police force, Deputy Dreamboat, locks him up and says, don't do anything stupid, which Steven will do very quickly. And Diana hands off her baby to Vicky and says, hey, take care of my child. I don't know what they have to do at the police station that they can't keep the baby around for, but whatever. Everyone has to be separated. It's a horror movie.
You'd think that the police station would be the safest place for the baby, but...
No, they put the baby in a cardboard box in a diner.
In the back room where the fry cooks keep the old grease.
So, Steven has been arrested. He's been taken into custody. His attractive friend has locked him away, told him not to get into any trouble. Well, wouldn't you know it, trouble is in the very next cell. It's in the form of one... and the only Creighton Duke, who says he looks like a sorry sack of shit and he's in a whole mess of trouble and he's the only way he can get out of it. And he has the information that can help him prove his innocence, but he's going to have to pay a price. And that price comes in the form of handing his hand over to Creighton so that he can lovingly stroke his fingers for a while.
Oh, the scene just goes on and on. And I knew it was coming, and I was cringing because I, as many horror movies as I have seen, I cannot take anything involving broken bones. Uh-huh. I know that there's another scene coming up that I will have to cringe and look away from the screen. But this scene is so prolonged. It's almost like that Family Guy type of humor where it's funny and then it stops being funny and then it eventually comes back around to being funny again because it just keeps going.
The reason why he's stroking his fingers is because Duke wants to fuck everyone in this movie. But more specifically, he is going to break Steven's fingers to see the metal of the man, I guess, is what it's being. I don't know why his idea of passing this information on that would eventually help him earn $500,000 means I'm going to break your fingers, which would make you less helpful in helping me earn $500,000. But well, I don't
To his credit,
the way Duke operates.
To his credit, Steven gives about the same, you know, subdued reaction to having his fingers broken as he did to having Diana, you know, murdered right in front of him. You know, he's a little pained, but you know, he's doing all right after a few minutes from having someone break his fingers.
I don't know. I got nothing on this one. It's just like, in terms of just like an actual choice, I don't know what that choice was. So,
well, let me ask you this, Michael. On a scale from Nightmare on Elm Street 2 to Possession, how sexualized is this scene where one guy in a jail cell fondles another man's fingers for pleasure, giggles, and then breaks his fingers one by one?
Oh, man. So my litmus is Nightmare 2 to Possession, because I would say that both of those are like way more sexual than this. I think that, I don't know, I would maybe firmly plant this somewhere in the exploding parrot scene of Nightmare 2, where it's just like, it happens, you're not sure why, but if it's going to move us forward, then like break the goddamn fingers and let's go. That's good.
But Michael, it happens because there's something inside of him that's trying to break free. And if his family knows about it, everything will blow up.
That's true. I mean, we're talking about Jesse in Nightmare 2.
Yeah.
And not Creighton Duke's need to just like snap a finger or two.
Any chance I can take to talk about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, I'm going to take.
Oh, it's a gift. It is a gift to cinema.
It is.
The gayest movie of all time. And I make a trade of talking about gay horror movies. And there are few that touch that. That's, you know, it's like Icarus coming close to the sun. Few compare.
So this plan works out perfectly for both of them. Duke wants to break fingers, and Steven needs information. And the information he learns is that Diana and his ex-girlfriend and his child are all secret members of the Voorhees clan. That we're not Jason. This is are we to assume that Diana is Pamela's daughter, or the only mentioned in the beginning of this movie and almost nowhere else until the Paramount movie that they ended up not making at the last minute, Elias Voorhees? Are they step brother and sister, or they're both the product of Pamela and Elias?
It's got to be Jason's dad, because I think that, you know, cray though she may be, Pamela seems so committed to Jason that if she had another kid, it would have come to play by now.
Mm-hmm.
And it also makes sense that if she was just sticking around the lake, cooking in a non-operable kitchen, that maybe Mr. Voorhees, like, busted off into his own life and has other families. I just think it's like, honestly, I mean, I realize that Diana was using a last name, but you know the best way to fly under the radar if you're related to the most famous serial killer in your town is not to just change your last name, but I don't know, move.
Like, yeah, I'm not sure why anybody still lives in this town. I don't know why the town has not been burned to the ground several times over.
Well, remember in part 6, they tried to change the name to like Forest Lake or Forest Green or whatever it is. But then at some point, someone was just like, meh, people keep dying. Let's just change it back. Like, there had to be like a Chamber of Commerce meeting to make the decision to change the name, change all the signage and like, you know, uniforms and things. And then after part 6, when Frank and Jason shows up, we're just like, let's just change it back. Because then all the signs change back again. There's a like, lot going on.
There's a certain point in the movies where a good half of the victims are people who just thought it would be fun to go see where, you know, 80 people were brutally murdered. Yeah, sure, let's just camp out here and get drunk and have sex outdoors where you know, so many people were brutally, senselessly slaughtered. Because that's what you do when you you could go bowling, you could go to the movies. No, we're going to go to the old campsite where dozens and dozens of people were murdered.
Oh, even non-Jason related motives are always like really kind of like just big question marks. The idea that in part 7 Tina like watched her dad die on a dock, and her therapist is like, you know what would be good for you getting over your dad's death is for us to go hang out where he died horribly. Let's just go, you know, it's a great weekend activity, that.
Well, otherwise we wouldn't get to see that dad's office, which is inexplicably full of train memorabilia and one picture of a space shuttle. Which was a detail I did not notice until I saw it on the big screen a month ago at a Scare LA Fest screening of it. And I was like, well, I saw all the train stuff before, but what is the space shuttle doing here?
It's classic dad decor.
Right. I think we all can agree that the space shuttle is the train of the cosmos.
I like it. Patrick has fallen silent. I think you've stunned him.
Oh my god, this thing is so crazy. So Steven pulls a we need help. He manages to get out of his jail cell by pulling the gun, which is, again, this is the second time we've seen this in a Friday the 13th movie where someone has managed to pull a deputy's gun on the deputy while inside of a jail cell. They're copying themselves now.
I don't think that is something that is actually a very common trope in action movies and horror movies. And it's probably one of the biggest examples of something that almost never bears itself out in real life. Normally, usually because most of the time deputies work in pairs, particularly when they're, you know, dealing with people in jail cells. Mm-hmm. But you see, it's such a common trope.
So Steven breaks out, and word of his escape has spread. It spreads to Joey's diner, and we see Joey, her large adult son, Ward, and Leslie Jordan.
I am 100% here for the Leslie Jordan and experience, the Leslie Jordan, Rusty Schwimmer, Joey and Shelby show. I have the knowledge that when they read for these parts, they actually were reading for the opposite roles. Like, Joey was supposed to be a man and Shelby mm-hmm. was supposed to be a woman. And I don't know what happened, but they decided to swap the parts, and that's what they ended up playing. And I just love that. I love that these two, and I also heard that Leslie Jordan and Rusty Schwimmer just improvised most of their scenes. And it makes sense because it's entertaining.
Yes, there's an electricity of people caring, or at least dedicating themselves to their character. Something that also happens with Creighton Duke. They sort of pop on screen. She has one particular line when Vicky brings in the baby, and Lisa says, "Oh, he's so cute," and Joey goes, "Hey, he could be just as cute sitting out on the sidewalk." Like, are you psychotic? What is this? You can't kick a baby out of your diner. But her solution, when she learns from the police that Steven is now on the loose and labeled a murderer, is put that baby in the back, make a crib out of something. So out go the lettuce leaves and in goes a child on top of a table.
And they did such a good job of hiding the baby that Steven is literally in the next room. Because somehow in the... I don't know. I mean, Crystal Lake is not a big town, mm-hmm. but he has gone directly to the diner. Somehow he knew the baby was going to be there. I am not sure how he knew the baby was going to be there, but he's exhibiting that unique to Friday the 13th telepathy.
My other favorite part of this scene is Leslie Jordan is sitting on his knees like a first grader on the rug waiting for story time.
He's waiting for someone to explain to him what's going on.
Yeah, I feel it. I feel it.
Here's the thing. Steven needs to find... Maybe he is looking for his ex-girlfriend. Maybe that is the idea here. Diana's gone, but... He is looking for, oh God, I've forgotten her name at this point.
Jessica,
Jesus. Well, we only just met her. It's not like I've been seeing her for a whole hour of this movie. She doesn't appear for the first 40 fucking minutes. So maybe that was his impulse, but he does see his baby for what he reports to be the first time. And then large adult son Ward comes in and instead of turning him in, gives him the keys to his car. For reasons.
Like I said, again, there's so much of this character that was left on the editing room floor that you're just supposed to assume that, you know, that generally speaking, you know, he's considered, you know, a town undesirable, but, you know, there are a few people who know he's, you know, just a good-hearted kid.
How do you become a town undesirable in Crystal Lake?
evidently it's you know, knocking up a 25-year-old woman, because Jessica, you know, I don't think they're supposed to be particularly young, but
no.
this is treated as some sort of, I feel like that this is, you know, almost like a town scandal that he got this girl pregnant and she left town, even though it's 1993?
But by the Friday the 13th timeline, it's probably like 2003 or 4, because the actual timeline of the movies, when you run it through, it would be way, way later than 93.
Right. Yeah, now you mentioned it, I think somebody did say it was supposed to be like 12 years after the last one. So yeah, nobody was just, you know, leaving town in a cloud of shame and secrecy when they're 25, because you're an unmarried mother.
That's right.
And actually, wait, how old is Jason? Because when you think about it, Jason would have was 11 years old when he drowned, and then so Pamela's like hanging out. He grows up to at least his 20s, so you've got a huge span there. And then in between 4 and 5, Tommy Jarvis has grown up into an adult, so there's at least a decade there, and he's like in a home. And then between 5 and 6, there's a couple years, and then Tommy drops Jason in the lake, and there's like another 20 years that pass. What is going on? Why is it always the 80s?
It's a time vortex. They live in a time vortex, and we're about to find out why. Because when Steven beats feet to Castle Voorhees, the existence of which just leaves more questions than answers, which was probably a better subhead for this movie than the final Friday, just leaves more questions than answers. This joint turns out to be a real Texas Chainsaw Massacre family home. Steven happens upon the Necronomicon from the Evil Dead movies.
I stopped the movie and I was like, what? I like wrote it in all caps. What? 4 question marks.
Honestly, I have to tell you, this was the point when I was watching this in preparation to do this episode with you both, that I was like, oh, okay. I'm glad that I have this segment, because I finally can say something about Jason Goes to Hell that I think this scene lends itself to, and it's both a compliment but not, and it's this. This movie is not a good Friday the 13th sequel. It's barely a Friday the 13th sequel. It's like adjacent to The World. But you know what it makes an okay sequel to, especially from this point onwards? An Evil Dead movie. This could be like an adjacent Evil Dead movie, especially for the two deaths that we're about to have coming. It's just like wonky, melty, crazy, like heads popping off and creatures crawling out and cabin in the woods. It's like, all right, if we're going to leave Jason behind and we're going to throw the book in there, let's just assume whatever. I'll know where Ash is, but like clearly this is what happens when Bruce Campbell's not around. It just goes cray.
The genius of this is that the first time Sam Raimi discovered that the Necronomicon, the actual prop used in Evil Dead 2, was in this movie, was when he saw the movie. No one asked, hey, is this okay? They just did it because one of the effects guys had worked on Evil Dead 2 and had that prop. So, yeah.
There's got to be some legality issues.
Well, he said, as long as you don't use it in any of the other movies, I'm fine. Sam Raimi seems to be a mensch in many ways and shapes and forms, and I guess he just let it slide. What could you do at this point? But it's also, this movie was seen by 14 people, so,
Two of which were Patrick and me.
This movie made $15.9 million at the box office, just so you know, from a $3 million budget. So that's just that's crazy to me, honestly.
It's amazing to me how little of this movie I remembered. Like, I was just like, just stunned when I saw that there was some vague tie-in to the Evil Dead movies. And then it's never really brought up again.
No. It's not. Things just happen and then are forgotten about because another amount of craziness is just around the corner.
I really wanted him to just find other. I wanted him to look at something on the wall, and then the camera pans in and it's the picture at the end of The Shining, or just, you know, or like
the puzzle box.
the puzzle box, Father Karras's medallion, just the storehouse of meaningful props from other horror movies.
Just get crazy. There's a bushel of killer tomatoes. There's a jar of this stuff. You know.
There's a killer baby from the It's Alive movies. I mean, just throw it all in.
Yeah, exactly.
Frankenfurter's lipstick.
Before Stephen can get too far into his investigation, guess who saunters into the house? Robert Campbell. And he takes a phone call on the most 90s of cell phones. And we now are treated to a three-minute, one-man show conversation with him and a producer. And he tells us all sorts of information. One, he wants to film the Voorhees house with fake props to make it creepier because the sex harness that he keeps touching only makes it feel more quaint. Let's bump this up a little bit. Number two, he has stolen Diana's body from the morgue so that the camera crew can find it. And with the sheriff boyfriend looking on, and this will equal somehow massive ratings.
It must be sweep sweep.
Cut to Deputy Jason bursting in, and they have a bit of a tussle, but it's not too hard. He doesn't have to strap him in this time. He just manages to lay old Robert Campbell down and give him a smooch. And the heartworm gets transferred to Robert Campbell, meaning there are now two slimy persons occupying the same body. and this then leads to a very elaborate scene of Josh melting on screen for what feels like hours, as if the K&B effects group were like, remember RoboCop? Let's do RoboCop. And they go about doing it rather fucking convincingly.
But the melting death, I think, lends credence to the, like, well, at least we're in an Evil Dead kind of world now. Because when have we ever seen something like this in a fright? Like, in a way, putting the Necronomicon right before that, where he, like, just ooze puddles out. That feels way more like a Raimi move than a Friday the 13th move.
Yes.
Well, here's my question. Shouldn't, as soon as somebody walked into the room where the sex harness is, shouldn't there have been a big old puddle of, Karin or Phil on the floor?
We don't know that there wasn't.
What happened to him?
He was swept up in a bucket by Deputy Jason, I suppose.
Jason's a big fan of cleanup.
I guess if he took the time to shave Deputy Josh, then I guess he's gonna clean up whatever ooze is left over of Karin or Phil.
I mean, if we know one thing about Jason is that he is an interior/exterior decorator. He does like to place bodies just so. So he's not going to just leave it hanging out. Like, there's a purpose to this.
He is an artist, thank you.
That's right. He wants to create a visual palette, and it's not just a pile of goo on a dining room table. I'm sure it's in a lovingly displayed in a tree somewhere outside.
Look, he learned it from his mom. They're a quaint people.
They
got home and garden. I'm very here for this.
Yes, there's many things in common in the Voorhees family. One of them is incredible forearm strength, and the other is the desire for everything to have a certain feng shui.
Jason decoupages in between films. It's a whole thing.
And so this leads us once again to everyone's favorite decision-making activity. It's choose your own death venture time. And as always, the rules are this. If you were forced to die in one of the ways we discussed in this section of the movie, which would you choose and why? Up for bid this time, we have knife sharpener to the back, Jason heartworm transfer, or just melting. And so, Michael, as our guest, it is your show. You get to choose first.
I mean, it's gotta be the heartworm transfer, right? Like, not only is it less egregious and horrible than the other two, but it also means that I get to be Jason for a bit. So I kind of just feel like, if we're going to lean into the world and I'm going to have to do this, I might as well get to be the main act for a little while. Even if it means that my throat has to bug out and I have to get all like bloodshot eyes, but whatevs. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, that's a horrible way to die, but it, then at least you kind of get to steal the show for a while. So I'm going to go with that.
Okay. Well, you do know that you're going to have to spend the rest of your time on this mortal coil wearing suspenders.
Yeah, I mean, there are sacrifices that one has to make. It's better than overalls, I guess.
You heard it here first. Suspenders better than overalls. All right, Gina, what say you?
I, too, am going to go with the heartworm, mostly because I just want to know what it's like to be able to throw someone through a window. I would like to know what it's like to have super strength, to be able to be in all places at all times. That would be very convenient for my morning commute. And I just want to be able to suddenly appear behind people, you know, scare them. I think it'd be kind of fun.
Sure. Why not? I'll tell you this right now. There's no way in hell I'm going with melting. That shit is crazy. I think I'm going to go with knife sharpener in the back. For one reason, and that is I'm not going to end up being buried. I'm going to be stolen by a TV producer and be shoved into a closet. And frankly, there's just something about burial that I don't like, and this gets me out of it. So that's where I'm going.
Well, I don't think they're going to leave her there.
Well, they kind of have to now.
Yeah.
Well,
eventually they'll retrieve her, I would imagine.
She fell into the basement. Who's going to want to go into the basement with all those melty bodies about?
You make an excellent point.
It's the only job I got. Well, there you have it. That's it for this section of the movie. Hey, Michael, where can people see, hear, and know more about you?
Well, you can find me, if you are interested in more of my shenanigans, directly on Twitter at Michael Verratti. That's V as in Victor, A-R-R-A-T-I. You can also follow my podcast on Twitter at Dead for Filth. We do a new episode every Friday where I sit with a different creator in the horror genre. And we talk about the relationship between the LGBTQ identity and horror. I've had a lot of really great people on, like Jeffrey Reddick, who created Final Destination, Darren Stein, who made Jawbreaker, Veronica Cartwright from Alien and Witches of Eastwick was just on. It's a fun series where I just sit and talk about creative things and our creative connections and otherness with this spooky genre that we all love. As a screenwriter, you can check out a lot of my movies. I do movies for Lifetime, Hallmark, Ion. I've also written a lot of indie horror films, one of which, Tales of Poe, actually stars Adrian King from the first Friday the 13th and Amy Steele from Friday the 13th Part 2. So I'm out there in the world. Just IMDb me and have a look.
Please do it today. Do it right away, people. Oh, Gina, where can people hear and see more from you on the internets?
That's a tough act to follow. I write about movies and television and other sundry things at GinaRadcliffe.com, and I am on Twitter at Porcelain72.
Excellent. All right, people, you know the drill. Would you mind rating and reviewing us on iTunes? If you do, let us know what your favorite kill is in the Friday the 13th series or any of the films we've covered. If you do that, we'll read it here on the air. That's our solemn vow to you, the Kill by Kill listener. Follow us on Twitter at Kill by Kill Pod, Instagram Kill by Kill Podcast, or our Facebook group. Just hit Kill by Kill inside your search window there and you'll find us. And that will do it for this episode. Don't worry, the body count will continue. And until next time, for myself and for Michael and for Gina, bye-bye, everybody. Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body.
Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.